From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Atlanta-based producer Will Packer has a new hit movie.
Baby Jesus, oh gee, Jesus, please don't make me pee on anybody.
Stop taking that picture, please, don't you?
That's an excerpt from Girls Trip. The female-led comedy raked it in at the box office this summer. We'll talk with Will Packer later this hour. But first, what are some of your favorite films made by Georgians or filmed here in Georgia? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Atlanta has a healthy appetite for improv and a whole slew of places where you can see it. We talked about this last week with comedian Colin Mockery of Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically, the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser.
Dad's Garage welcomes another headliner this week. You may know Scott Adsit as Pete Hornberger on 30 Rock.
Who drank this? This is the scotch I was saving for my birthday. Someone with the key to my office, a janitor or a security guard or some black-hearted individual, probably white, has ruined the Hornberger hang for all of us.
Scott Adsit is in Atlanta this weekend at Dad's Garage Theater and joins me from New York. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, I mean, how much do you think of your performance experience? I mean, you started out at Second City, but at this point, how much of the performing that you do is actually improvised?
Well, I still do a lot of improv on stage in New York and around the country at festivals and things like that, and at Dad's Garage. It's still a big part of my life.
Why?
Because I get to do it for no money.
Isn't that in the con column?
Yeah, well, no, it's just really, really fun, and it allows me to be with people I may not be with otherwise and play with them. And I just am surrounded in New York and in Chicago and in L.A. by all these people I've worked with over the years, and I just love to play with them. So I get on stage as much as I can.
So I'm wondering if you also take what you do in improv into your regular life. And I say that because here's this comment from comedian Mike Birbiglia. He was speaking to NPR about how he uses improv.
The principles of improv apply to everything. I mean, saying yes and helps in parenting and being a good husband and being a good friend and, you know, any kind of collaborative job, working at the radio or working at an advertising agency.
What do you feel about this idea that improv actually bleeds into everything you do?
Well, it becomes a philosophy once you kind of like get into it. I think new students of improv get over a hurdle and suddenly realize how broad their horizon is, and they kind of apply the rules or at least the guidelines of improv into their everyday lives, and they become happier people because they're more accepting and they do listen and they apply these tenets that really make you have a better time on stage by serving everyone else. And then that really applies in life as well. And just little things, like I had a teacher say to me once on stage, if you're interested, you're interesting, because there's a tendency for some people to play for a laugh that they're not interested in what's going on. And it just kind of stops the action and your character becomes less interesting. And that applies to life too. If you're someone who doesn't have any interest, then you're less interesting. And the more interested you are in something, the more people want to pay attention to you. And so there are a lot of things like that that just apply very communitively to everyday life.
You know, it kind of struck me as interesting that another one of your passions seems to be stop motion animation. I mean, you did Moral Oral and then also Frankenhole, both for Adult Swim. And to me, stop motion animation is sort of the opposite of improv.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, one is totally spontaneous, and one is like every single second is sort of agonized over.
Right, but all those agonizing seconds are based on spontaneous moments that we write down. So we find spontaneity while we're writing or while we're kind of like throwing out ideas at each other, and then when the animators, these brilliant animators, get in the booth on their stages and start animating, they can translate that spontaneity into something beautiful.
So let me ask you about typecasting or ending up being typecast. Because for some people, you are always going to be Pete Hornberger from 30 Rock. And I asked this to one of your co-stars, Jack McBrayer, who's from Georgia. And I guess people ask him all the time if he's worried about getting typecast. Here was his response.
I have a couple different responses because I think of people like Don Knotts and I think of people like Bob Newhart, Andy Griffith, Bea Arthur. These are actors who didn't stray too far from, you know, their signature style. And they worked for decades and they worked very well. So for me, it's not about like getting typecast. It's like, let me just get cast and then I'll worry about type later on.
Does it ever worry you that you'll may always be known as being on 30 Rock?
Well, I'm very proud of being on 30 Rock, and I'll never say I'm not. I do like playing. I mean, I kind of grew up on the stage where I got to play a lot of different types of people. So I enjoy the idea of playing lots of different kinds of guys. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's the best part of my job because I get to play something I'm not used to playing. Am I afraid of typecasting? No, I'm not afraid of it. I avoid it because I feel like I've already painted that picture and signed it, kind of. So I want to, you know, see what else I can do and or at least show what I can do.
Well, I mean, I guess it helps that you don't have a Georgia accent, which might help.
That's all. Jack is faking all of that.
I'll tell him he said that.
No, he's from Long Island and he just adds ma'am to stuff.
Well, then, I mean, people may not realize you played a really different character in a hit movie, but they may not have realized it was you because you were the voice of the robot Baymax in Big Hero 6. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
Hey, Baymax, I didn't know you were still active.
I heard a sound of distress. What seems to be the trouble?
Oh, I just stubbed my toe a little. I'm fine.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain?
A 0?
So how different is the job of voicing a character as opposed to acting a character?
Well, quite often you're alone in the booth, for one thing. You're just kind of dealing with the director and maybe the writers.
Does that make it harder to not have energy to play off of?
It can. It depends on the kind of scene you're doing. With Baymax, I am in the booth alone, but since Baymax is generally a collection of previously recorded words, he doesn't have a lot of emotional interaction. And in the course of the movie, it kind of bends that way, and you can kind of infer emotion from him. But generally, he's just kind of like reorganizing the library of words he has and giving them back to you. So that's not unusual. I think it probably works a little better for me not to get too emotional with people in that movie and the series we're doing. But in things like Moral Oral, we had this tiny little booth, which is about the size of a New York shower in a New York apartment. So like, you know, 4 feet by 4 feet and a mic and 6 to 8 of us in a room gathered around that mic.
I hope you all showered.
Sweating on each other. Yeah. Oh, I wish there was a shower head in that booth, believe me. And we would do entire scenes, sometimes, you know, 10-minute scenes, all gathered around this mic and playing off each other.
How do you keep from loving someone too much?
Glad you asked, Oral. Love is a very beautiful, very intense feeling for a startlingly short period of time. Before long, you realize it just gets in the way of the real important things in life, like just going to sleep or being left alone.
And that's really great. But I don't have a preference, really. I think it's cool to go down a list of lines, which is generally what you do, and just see how you can craft it and change it. And really just listen to your skate along your voice and play with it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with comedian Scott Adsit. He's performing a series of improv shows at Dad's Garage Theater Company in Atlanta on Friday and Saturday. Perhaps more than ever in the United States, at least, comedians are becoming a political force, or at least in some way political commentators. So much so that, say, you know, Jimmy Fallon has got himself into a lot of trouble by tousling Donald Trump's hair. And that's a show that he says he thinks of as being completely non-political. And I wonder what you think the role of a comedian is in either talking about politics or leaving it alone.
Well, I think it's down to the comedian. There's so many types of comedians in the world, and the ones who point at political stuff have become very important now because everyone's thinking about how the world is coming apart because of who we elected. I think they're very important. And the problem is, I think they get maybe to be a little too important recently because I think the audience now views it's possible that they're viewing politics as entertainment and just fodder for something to laugh at. And of course it isn't. There's terrible, terrible things happening. I think comedy can point out truth. That's what good comedy is. Any good comedy is just pointing at truth. And that can activate people. Understanding something because it makes no sense and you see the truth of the nonsense and you need to fight against that, then I think that can cause an uprise, and that's great. But then there also is the more passive people who just see it as something happening to other people and just a source of delight, which it can be dangerous. But I wouldn't say that they shouldn't. I think it's more important that we have as many voices as we can in this debate, and especially the ones pointing at truth.
Before we go, I got to ask you about how things have changed in television since you first started in the industry. Because, you know, Tina Fey went straight from doing 30 Rock, well, not straight, but kind of directly, to working up a show for Netflix. Like, we live in a really different consumer environment for television than even 10 years ago. And I wonder if you see that as a net positive or a net negative.
The only negative, I think, is that we're not all watching something at the same time and we can talk about it the next day. And there's kind of a shared community in watching something, which we used to have. But nevertheless, we still, you know, there are days when no one on TV, including CNN, is talking about anything but Game of Thrones, which is interesting. And we still have these touchstones and references that everyone kind of knows. And I think it's good that the Netflix and Amazons of the world are attracting big talent like Tina, because they're the new format that is a little more lenient, a little more broad-minded, and allows things that maybe wouldn't be allowed on regular TV, and also avoids commercial breaks. It maybe frees up the writers to write without having to have a cliffhanger every 6 minutes.
What was the last thing that you binge watched?
There's a British show called Utopia, which was on a couple years ago. Did you ever see it?
It's a
conspiracy theory thing, and it's really well written and really well performed. It's great.
Okay, well, that is comedian Scott Adsit. He's performing a series of improv shows at Dad's Garage Theater Company in Atlanta. Improv can't be binge-watched. You can get detail at gpbnews.org. Scott, a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, more Latino teens have reported being bullied since the election. But first, I talk with filmmaker Will Packer about his hit movie, Girls Trip. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A while back, we talked about women's growing role in major film and television projects. L'Oreal Broussard of Women in Film and Television Atlanta says films starring women often do well where it counts.
It always starts from the top down, and that means like at your big studios in Los Angeles and even the ones here in Atlanta. They're always thinking, of course, of the bottom line and the financials, but one thing that you've seen this year and the past 2 years, that just even with female leads and diverse female leads in films, those films have made the most money, you know, at the box office.
Girls Trip is no exception. It cost $19 million to make, and it's grossed more than $90 million since opening in theaters last month. Atlanta-based producer Will Packer produced that film, and he joined me in our studio last week.
Hey, Celeste, what's happening?
Not much. Well, let's talk about Girls Trip.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so proud of that movie. So cool. Such a good time.
You know,
like making it and seeing the release of it.
And I want, you know, I went to see the release of it, and audiences are loud.
They are. Yes, they are.
When they see this movie.
They're having a good
time.
Which
kind of adds to the experience.
You go with the right audience. It's a party in the theater. You go to one of those theaters that serves drinks, and you get the ladies with the wine. They are having a ball. I love it. Mission accomplished.
You must get a ton of pitches and scripts given to you. How do you know a good script from a bad one?
You have to have a vision and a plan for the type of content you're looking for and that you want to make, and you have to stick to that. And, you know, I am fortunate that I'm in a position where I do get a lot of content. You know, very rarely do I meet somebody that doesn't have either. The thing about me is when I meet people, it's either they have an idea for a movie or they have an amazing kid. Like, that's all I get. Like, it's just, like, and I guess sometimes before the person starts talking, I'm like, okay, this one has got the cute kid. You know, I can just tell, or no, this has got the true story that they're going to pitch me. But that's what I get all the time. So the good thing about that is that I am exposed to a lot of different creative ideas, and some of them are really good. And for me, I have to think about, okay, what is the type of content that I want to make? I feel like I have a responsibility to do content well, and do content that does have certain imagery. And I also have an economic imperative to make content that is commercial. You try to get that sweet spot of commercial and critical acclaim, which we got with Girls Trip, which is awesome. And so, yeah, that's kind of my approach to, you know, kind of figuring out, wafting through, you know, all the pitches and ideas to find stuff that is a Will Packer project.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Girls Trip. This is just a clip from the trailer.
Girls, you know you got those friends. The ones that got your back. The ones that keep it real. We haven't hung in 5 years. We need a Girls Trip.
So an interesting thing is that when people are talking about this movie and previous successes that you've had.
Yes.
They're talking about how good you are at targeting a specific audience. And in this case, I assume they mean targeting a black female audience. Mm. Is that your goal? Because when I was at the theater, there was all kinds of people.
Everybody,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's when you really win. You know, I think more than ever, audiences are not segregating themselves, I think. And we as filmmakers have to be aware of that and make content accordingly. I have always tried to make content that felt inclusive, not exclusive, that even though it may be specific in the characters, it may have been made through a particular lens, it may thematically be specific to, you know, a particular culture, but feels universal. I try to make sure that I make projects that have universal themes and entry points. That's so important. So, Girls Trip, there are four black women in the leads of that movie, and they are behaving in the way that some black women behave. And they're doing it in a really natural, authentic, organic way, and we did a great job capturing that. Now, that doesn't mean that it's just for black women and that non-black women can't enjoy the film. And in fact, as you point out, they have been enjoying the film. That's the balance. As a filmmaker, you know, movies that have been starring white people have been made forever, and non-white people have been going to the movies, you know, partially because that's the only movies that were made for a long time, but also because, you know, they just accept majority culture and they enjoy it. And, you know, Will Ferrell and, you know, Amy Schumer are funny. So you go to those movies no matter whether you look like them or not. I think the same thing is now starting to be true about Regina Hall and Queen Latifah and Tiffany Haddish and Jada Pinkett Smith.
So let's hear from another one of your movies that people have probably heard of, and that's Straight Outta Compton. In this particular clip, the crew is getting there. They've been patted down, and they're being harassed by local police, and the manager's not happy about that.
Get down. Get on the ground now.
We're trying to check these bangers, make sure they're clean.
All right, I'm sorry. These are not bangers. These are artists.
What kind of artists?
Rappers, and they're working with me in the studio right now.
Well, see, rap is not an art. And I'm sorry, who are you?
I'm the manager.
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like.
But that's police harassment.
So it's kind of this cliche in Hollywood, right, that somebody will say, well, I'm doing this cheesy bad movie because I want to be able to afford to do art. But then you look at something like Straight Outta Compton, where you seem to have this sense of where those two intersect.
Yeah.
So how far do you need to get into a script before you know you found it?
Well, you know what? I think that, you know, Straight Outta Compton was obviously a biopic, so it's a little bit of a different approach. And F. Gary Gray did an amazing job. That was, you know, the project he was born to direct. So with a biopic, you're trying to be true to the story, the people involved. You know, you're creating art around true events, which is a whole different challenge and requires a different skill set. But at the end of the day, if you're true to what the story is and it happens to be commercial, then you win. So you don't take license just to make it commercial when you're telling a true story, in my opinion.
There's some biopics that are really deadly dull and boring, though, because they've stayed
right.
too true.
Yeah, and that's the balance. I mean, I would argue probably those biopics did not need to be told in that medium. You know, and not to say that they couldn't have been made exciting. I don't know. You know, we're not talking about a specific biopic, but there, every story that, you know, doesn't need to be told as a movie, as a feature film on theatrical screens. Like, there are some great stories out there that should just remain great stories. And you know, maybe somebody should write them down. They should remain as books. But, you know, it rarely do I meet somebody that doesn't think their story is a TV show or a movie. And the reality is that that's just not the case. You know, all true life stories are not created equal. That's just the harsh reality of it. Very rarely do I hear, and they're interesting stories. I always get pitched like the first, you know, the first person to do this, the first person to do, and that's great. And I want like that to be something that, you know, my kids know. You know, and that they can learn about, and maybe that's something I can put out on a digital format or in other short form content. But it doesn't mean in today's environment that people will be willing to go and sit in a theater and watch that film.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Atlanta-based filmmaker Will Packer. His movie Girls Trip is showing in theaters nationwide. Let's talk about Kevin Hart.
Okay.
You were one of the first people to really recognize the potential there, and it's now... Again, a running joke at Kevin Hart getting pretty much every role that there is for the funny sidekick. So first, let's hear a little bit. This is from the movie Ride Along. Again, a huge success that you produced. Kevin Hart and Ice Cube catch up to the criminal at last that they've been chasing.
What you doing? Hey, how stupid are you to hide out in the same place we found you before, Jay?
Plain sight, classic tactic, man.
You better tell me where that Serbian buy is going down, boy, or I'm gonna give you a classic tactic.
Ain't telling you nothing.
Or you going to jail with a bullet wound.
You think he playing with you? You think he got time for games? This man is crazy. If he pull a gun out, that means he's serious.
What makes Kevin Hart so good on film?
Kev is, he's a unique talent. You know, he has an ability to self-deprecate, to use what other people have perceived as a negative as a positive. You know, he's short, his diminutive stature works it for his advantage. He also has been around for a while, so he's honed his act. Like, you know, it's interesting, you know, when you said that I was one of the people to help bring him to prominence, that is a true statement, but he'd been around for a while. And when I was talking to people about Kevin Hart for Think Like a Man, you know, some of the pushback I got from other studios outside of Sony, where I eventually made it, was, yeah, we know Kevin Hart, you know, he's not a star. He's had movies, you know, he made Soul Plane and that tanked. He had a sitcom that failed. He's been around for a while. He should just be, you know, supporting actor. He's not a leading man. And now, of course, all those studios will pay big dollars to have him in their films. I think that all those years of working and grinding and grinding and being told, you know, he was, you know, to this, to that, not enough this, not enough that, he's used to his advantage. He has honed, you know, his voice to the point where now it's being received in a big way, really around the world.
So another thing you're really well known for, and a lot of people have said about you, is how calm you are on the set. And also that you're very good at working with big egos.
Egos. Yes. Welcome to Hollywood.
How do you do that? How do you work with an outsized ego?
You know, this is a very, this is an industry that feeds those beasts. This is an industry that rewards bad behavior. It creates adversarial conditions often. That's what happens, you know? You got a lot of people that are yellers and screamers and big personalities, type A personalities. And I'm a type A personality. I'm very aggressive and I'm very confident. But I know how to be even keeled. I know how to approach things in a way so that I don't get too high or too low. You have to maintain that. My opinion to be successful in this business has worked very, very well for me. While everybody else is screaming and running around and yelling fire, I'm looking for the hose, you know what I mean, to put it out.
What about when there are some stories, though, and again, I will not mention any names, but there's stories of you having to intercede in arguments between, say, a director and a star.
Sure.
And then nobody wins that.
Well, I don't know that I agree, because you know when everybody wins, when the argument is settled and you're making the best movie possible. So that's what I have to do. I have to bridge the gap. I have to get them to see that you see left and he sees right, you see green, he sees orange. But at the end of the day, we're all trying to make the same movie.
So you have, for your entire career, I mean, it sounds to me like you launched in this career, even going back to the $20,000 Florida film.
Oh boy, yes. Chocolate City. That, at FAMU.
Yeah, Florida you had A&M. This goal to create movies that African Americans could see themselves in,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Over all that period of time, we haven't seen a lot of give in Hollywood else, right? In other production companies, we've seen that the diversity of actors and directors and producers, there's not been a huge amount of progress there. Why, as the decades go by, does that not change?
Well, I think it has changed, but I think that what you're speaking to speaks to how far we had to go, right? So, in other words, it's like if we're running a race and you start off 10 miles ahead of me, and then we look back 5 years and you're 5 miles ahead of me, you're still way too far ahead of me. But it's because I had so far to catch up. So there's been progress. But there was such a dearth of you know, African-American filmmakers and storytellers, and really of color, minority
not
groups.
White male.
White males have run it for a very long time. And so, you know, power seeds nothing without demand. Well, audiences are demanding it now. They're demanding to see themselves on the screens. And Hollywood, at the end of the day, is a big old business. That's what it is. It looks like art. It looks like, you know, it's a creative community, and some of it is, but it's a big business. It's a big corporation that, just like every other corporation, has, you know, shareholders and economic mandates that they have to answer to. And so in order to make sure that you are building your Hollywood company and business the most efficient way, you have to have content that the world can consume, that this country can consume, and that all aspects of this country can consume. If you want to be successful, you got to appeal to a broad audience. And now a broad audience is not just white.
So before we go, let's talk about Black America.
Okay.
Because it's in the same
the
sort
TV
of...
The TV show, not as a
right,
whole.
Right, not Black the, America yeah, as an all African Americans
who are in
the United
States. I was
going
to try to speak for us all, but...
I mean, we are in Atlanta, but still. No, the TV show, which is... It takes place in it's an alternative timeline in which, after the Civil War, African Americans actually took over three states in
that's
the South.
Right. That's right.
That was part of reparations for all the literally centuries of slavery.
Correct.
So that is not getting a huge number of headlines. What's getting a lot of headlines is Confederate,
right,
the proposed TV series at HBO,
right,
in which the South wins the war.
Yes.
Rather than forcing you to comment on Confederate,
mm-hmm,
can you explain why your series, Black America, is the right way to do this?
What I will say, because, you know, the implication is that here's what I will say, why I decided to do Black America and why that's content that I decided to be a part of and help bring to life, because I think that It's provocative. It's edgy. It is it's risky, but not in a way that offends a large group of people, because it revisits a very, very painful part of history that we are still dealing with in a way that continues to aggravate an existing wound. That's what I will say. So Black America, which, as you stated, imagines what if post-Civil War reparations were given to former slaves and they formed their own sovereign nation. And it's a contemporary look at what would happen if that had happened post-Civil War. What would that world and what would America as we know it look like today? To me, that's interesting content. It's challenging to do it right. You know, we've got to make sure that we do a good job with it. But it's the type of content that I, you know, I'm proud to be a part of and that I would want to see. And I think that I have a responsibility as a storyteller, regardless, you know, of my ethnicity. Because that is still a sensitive area, I have a responsibility to do everything I can to make sure that I'm telling that story in an appropriate, responsible way.
That was filmmaker Will Packer. His group Girls Trip is in theaters nationwide. Just ahead, where are all the Latino teachers in Georgia? First, though, the rise in bullying among Latino teens. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we talk about Monday's much-anticipated solar eclipse. If you're excited for that event, we want to hear about it. What are your plans to view this rare celestial phenomenon? Call and tell us at 404-500-9457. I hope you've at least bought some protective glasses. You can also let us know on social media and be sure to join us 9 a.m. Monday for more. Latino youth are being harassed and bullied more since the November presidential election. That's according to the Atlanta-based Clinic for Education, Treatment, and Prevention of Addictions. But the Georgia Department of Education says it has not gotten complaints about bullying of Latino students since the election. We talked earlier this year with Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News. Also joining us was Belisa Urbina, executive director of Ser Familia. Her organization provides counseling and other services to Hispanic families in the metro Atlanta area. Andy, why the discrepancy in numbers between this report saying that there's an uptick and the Department of Education saying there isn't?
Well, that's a very good question, Celeste. I think that it may be that the safety hotline run by the Department of Education isn't very well known to folks in schools, or because the surveys and the actual people on the ground are saying that this is happening.
And, Belisa, is this what you are also hearing from the people that you interact with, that there has been an uptick?
Yes, certainly. This is what we hear every day from parents and students as well.
What kind of bullying are they talking about?
They are talking about telling students, you know, racial slurs, destroying property in school, harassing kids, you know, posting messages in Facebook. So it has gotten really bad. Bad enough that I have heard so many parents tell us that they don't want to send the kids to school.
Is this bullying coming from other students for the most part?
For the most part, it's other students. But you also see, like yesterday, we had a family at the office in which they have had to post, went to the police and put a temporary protection order against a neighbor.
Andy, why is this a health care matter?
Well, the victims of bullying, Celeste, tend to have more mental health problems. They lose self-esteem. They lack confidence. And other very major effects in terms of their education. I mean, they don't go to school as often, and you know, the effect of bullying can be very, very difficult to accept or to kind of take in, especially for younger children.
But this is an issue. If it is true that there's just a lack of awareness about this hotline, so people aren't using it, and yet bullying affects so severely a kid's outcomes at school, that would seem to me to be a problem for the Georgia Department of Education.
I think what's happening, Celeste, is it's a school-by-school thing. In other words, the people at the state level are not as involved as what's happening on the ground at each particular school. And I think the principal is really the change agent here. He or she can really set the tone for inclusion or just kind of letting things go as they normally go. And that's the person, I think, at the school level is where you see more reports of this, and maybe they don't filter up to the actual state government level.
How do you counsel parents and students to handle this when they come to you? Do you find that the schools are being proactive in handling these kind of reports?
Some of them are and some of them are not. You know, we have received many calls from principals. I agree with what Andy is saying. And we also have gotten, you know, several calls from parent liaisons on the ground level that they are concerned about the issues. And I even had a principal call me 1 week right after the election and says, this has gotten so bad that some days I just think, you know, I just should send everybody home and just let it cool for a couple of days. So normally what we tell parents and students is find ways to just voice their what is going on, make the principal responsible for, you know, addressing the situation, because there's only so much that the parents can do. And then working with the self-esteem and communication skills at home.
Andy, studies show that Latino kids here in our state have among the highest rates of depression and anxiety of any in the state or even the country. But that existed also. It may have gotten worse since November, but that existed before the presidential election as well. Do we have any idea why?
I think it's the dynamic of these kids. They have these situations at home where it might be the kids are born here, they're U.S. citizens, but it might be a parent or an uncle or a cousin that is here undocumented. And so there's all sorts of anxiety and tensions that go along with that. Plus, you have the recent crackdown by the Trump administration on immigration. And so it's probably just exacerbated from that point.
Do you have other things to add in terms of why there are these high rates of depression and anxiety among Latino youth?
Sure. And you have to add to that Latina girls in Georgia have the highest suicide attempt rate in the state and one of the highest in the nation. Many studies tell us that is 1 out of 5. That is outrageous. Part of it also has to do...
1 out of 5 young Latino women in the state commit attempt suicide at some
mm-hmm.
point.
Yes, ma'am.
If you're just joining us, I am speaking with Belisa Urbina. She's executive director of Ser Familia. Also, Andy Miller, who is an editor for Georgia Health News. We're talking about reports that there's been an uptick in bullying of Latino students. So, Belisa, if something occurs between two students, this is the problem with bullying of any kind, right? That it then becomes a he said, she said problem. So is there something the state is not doing that it could do to cut down on these incidents of bullying and also the impact that it has?
I think that, you know, part of the problem is that many times we think, oh, this is a Latino problem. What we have seen for years is that Latino students in a school, they are treated like they are different. So many times, you know, they don't intervene in the situations. The problem is, like Andy said, 85 to 90% of our Latino young people are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. They are here to stay. If we don't allow them to get, you know, better outcomes, and when I say better outcomes, it's not giving them the chance to go to college. It's working on their family relationships and self-esteem. But even the state and the schools, they don't have resources. Many times I get calls from the school sending their students to us. You know, none of the community service boards that are mandated to deal with mental health in the metro area have anybody that speaks Spanish. No counselors, no psychiatrists. Many of the health systems don't have any psychiatrists that speak Spanish. They don't have counselors either. None of the domestic violence safe houses have bilingual counselors on staff. So the very few agencies that provide mental health in Spanish end up getting all of those clients. To give you an idea, for every person that we admit on our mental health counseling program, we have 3 to 4 waiting for a space. So the demand is outrageous, and there is very little that schools or anybody is doing to help these Latino young people.
Andy, is it fair to say that we don't actually know why there has been an uptick of bullying among Latino youth? I mean, it's occurred, they say the increase occurred since the November presidential election, but that doesn't mean we know why.
Well, you're right. And basically, you know, the president ran his campaign on building a wall and tough immigration policy and things like that. And And I think that the atmosphere that we see in our politics is that there's a lot of division, there's a lot of hate, and all that kind of bubbles up, and we're seeing the effects of that in schools. I also want to say that Muslim kids are also targeted in some cases.
Although we don't yet have statistics on incidents of bullying.
That's correct.
How is the state responding, if it is responding at all, to this report, to these reports showing an increase in bullying? Has there been any?
I haven't heard of any, and again, I go back to the principals and to the school districts. I mean, that's where you're going to see real change. The education system is kind of decentralized in this state, and where policy is really made is on the level of each school, and you see some principals really advocating inclusion and involving all kids in extracurricular activities, and so it's kind of a unifying message, and that's where you're going to see the real change here.
That's Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News, and you also heard Belisa Urbina, executive director of Ser Familia. Georgia's Latino population is growing, but schools can't find enough Latino teachers. Fair Street Elementary in Gainesville has roughly 60% Latino students, but only a handful of Latino teachers. We recently talked with Julio Cabañas, an assistant principal at Fair Street Elementary. He was Gainesville's first Latino administrator. Why is it important? I mean, having just heard this conversation about the uptick in bullying and how dangerous that is, why is it important then to have Latino teachers? Can they help with the problem we just heard about?
Absolutely. If you look at the background of the Latino teachers that we have, and as well as myself, we come from similar backgrounds of having immigrant parents. Most of us were born in this country. So we have that situation where you need to have those strong leaders and role models to be able to say that I have a voice in this situation. Being able to say, I am proud of my heritage and I will speak up for myself is something that's important for our students. Luckily, we did not have the strong boom right after the election of students to be scared and wanting to go. There were a handful of students, but our administrative team immediately got on that and started saying the importance of inclusion of all our students and being proud of who you are and not to worry about those situations. Your main focus is just to continue to work on school and to continue to improve yourself as a person, not to worry about the outside situations that really the children had no control over.
So why is it so difficult? And this difficulty in finding Latino teachers is statewide, anywhere that we have a large population of Latino and Latina kids. So why is it so difficult to recruit these teachers?
It's not necessarily that it's a difficult thing. It's just maybe possibly a situation of opportunity. I am blessed to work in a school system where we are 65% Hispanic as a district. Our school, as a matter of fact, our district, we have the highest in the entire state of English language learners at 32%. Being able to come to a situation where you have the opportunity to be a voice and to move forward is important. Gainesville City Schools has a great working relationship with two universities, the University of North Georgia and Brenau University, trying to work to recruit more Hispanic administrators and Hispanic teachers for that purpose, to have the future set up for our students as our community continues to grow in diversity as it does.
What are the strategies you think? I mean, I've heard that and I've read that universities in their training programs can actually make a huge difference in who actually ends up going into teaching. But specifically, how does that work? What are the programs that actually are effective?
It's just a matter of, you know, for the students to understand the communities that they're working with, to be able to go out in a community-based situation. We as a school, as Fair Street, are very much community-based. Our teachers know that they have the voice to speak to the parents. The parents are always included in any situations we make. It's a great feeling for a parent to call in and they're concerned with the first question they ask is, you know, ¿hablas español? And when you can answer yes, just the comfort level, making them feel more comfortable of calling the school, of being able to participate is a big thing. Just basically, as long as the teachers know that...
I want to stop you for just a moment,
sure.
I think often that when we think about why it's important to have Latino teachers, mm-hmm. we think about them being bilingual and speaking to the students. You're saying it's even more important that they're able to speak to the parents.
That's the first thing. The first step is community involvement, because once you get the parents involved, the students are happier to have that situation. And when a student is able to know that their parent can call in for a positive situation and the administration or the teachers can communicate back, it makes the student happier to focus on their grades, to focus on attendance, which is the main thing. I mean, a lot of the Hispanic parents, if they feel, you know, their student needs to stay home for a certain amount of time, or they think that, you know, I can take them out of school for 2 months to go down to Mexico or wherever. They need to understand, you know, there's ramifications for that. The student needs to stay in school, needs to stay on that track. We can't be so lackadaisical of saying, all right, they could take 2 months off and they'll just jump back into it. 2 months of schooling is a long time. So the importance of attendance, behavior, and classroom performance are a big focus we have in our district.
How involved are you with all the students? I mean, how involved is an assistant principal to become in their daily classroom lives?
I mean, I was on it from the moment when it started. I left a different district, but immediately when I met the superintendent at the time, Dr. Creel, her focus and vision on One Gainesville and moving forward absolutely just enamored me, and I had to be in there. The next thing I did was I looked at the pictures of our school board. And immediately, just the diversity of our school board in itself, there's Caucasian, African-American, and Hispanic leaders, shows that they are leading towards community involvement. Every day within the system, I speak to parents. We're out there, the administrative team, just for the students to know we have two minority leaders in our school, the principal and myself. You know, he's an African-American male, I'm a Hispanic male. Just having that opportunity for the students to see, wow, these are great leaders who look like me, who have the same similar background of me, just makes it happier and a better situation every day.
And then how does that change then the educational outcomes for the kids? I mean, they're all still learning the same curriculum. So how does the diversity of the school board and the administrative staff have an effect?
It really does, because it makes you more proud of the heritage you are, regardless if you're a Cuban background, if you're Mexican, if you're El Salvadorian, just knowing that there is a great opportunity here for me in the future. I can be a teacher. Teachers lead everything, or I can be a police officer, I can be a fireman. The main important part is, no matter what you have in front of a Cuban, African-American, the main part is the second part of the word, which is American, which is what we all are, and our focus is the students and getting to work together.
But as I'm sure you're aware, there's a shortage of teachers, period.
Very much so.
It doesn't matter
regardless of the situation.
Regardless of background, we're having trouble in America and also in Georgia in recruiting teachers.
Yep.
So can you give me your best pitch? What's your best pitch for me as a college student to become a teacher?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, and I say that because we also need, you know, strong male role models in the elementary school as well. Teaching is the foundation for everything, whether it's being a police officer, whether it's being a firefighter, whether it's being president. All of those people were taught by, of course, educators. And we all have that one teacher or two or three and hopefully more where you can say, I went into this field because of that person. Just having someone that you know is there who cares for you every day, it's basically just like having an additional parent. We are there with these students for most of the part time, more than their own families in itself. So for them to have that caring feeling, for a teacher to know my opinion is valued, my work ethic is valued, that's the main thing. Allowing all the teachers to have their own style and to do what they need to do, then manage their own classrooms. But no, our main funneling down is to get our students to improve in every aspect of the day.
What else needs to happen? If you were going to have the power to change one thing in education that might especially impact kids of diverse mm-hmm. backgrounds, what would that be?
I would just hope that more opportunities given. I mean, for more Hispanic leaders to do that, to be given those opportunities to run a school. I'm more than capable of running a school right now, and I'm excited for it. But the situation where I'm in right now, being able to take a school like we have this past year and just show that regardless of we're 60% Hispanic, 25% African-American, those schools can compete with just as well as students in schools that are 2% diverse. It's just a matter of the curriculum is going to be the same. It's how you teach it and how you move forward and be proud of your own self and heritage.
That was Julio Cabañas, an assistant principal at Fair Street Elementary in Gainesville. And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your thoughts. So how do we make sure that teachers reflect their students, both their language and their culture, and how important is that, do you think? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457, or you can find us on Facebook as well. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.